Hi, everyone. I'm Rich Limesider, as you all know, Executive Director at Safe Passage Project. And I will do the 30-second summary, which is to say Safe Passage Project has one mission only. We provide free lawyers to child refugees who are being deported, is the least legal way of saying that, for better or worse, I know, for some of the experts on the call. And right now, Safe Passage is providing free legal services to 1,247 clients with the support of 40 incredible staff. Some of you, you'll hear from on the conversation today, and more than 500 pro bono attorneys. And the way we're heading, we'll probably end the year with about a $4.2, $4.3 million budget for the year. So that's the sort of short summary about Safe Passage Project. Really, the privilege that I have today is to introduce Professor Lenny Benson, our founder, godmother, intellectual foundation, the woman who started with, Desiree just texted me, 1,265 clients, more than last week. The woman, Professor Benson Lenny, who really started everything off doing volunteer work, taking cases with students out of the New York Law School, the charismatic firebrand, gadfly activist, also the woman who literally writes the textbook on immigration law. And so we are incredibly privileged. I've chosen, you know, 11 of the 42 things one can say about Lenny with gratitude, but we're very privileged to have Lenny as our host and moderator for what promises to be a pretty interesting conversation over the next hour. So thank you, Lenny, take it away.
Okay, first of all, I'm gonna show everyone a housekeeping slide so that if you're having technology issues or you have any concerns how we're gonna run this, we are recording the presentation. We ask that you would mute yourself so we don't hear your kitties or puppies or young people scampering through the house, or your husband or spouse. We will be able to help you. Vicky Metier is the staff person who emailed you to confirm you have her contact. So if something goes wrong, please feel free to contact her. But also, you see that you can use the chat function to go ahead and post questions. So I am going to stop sharing this now. Come back to our happy faces. I want to say welcome to everyone. You know, at first when I was preparing for today, I thought about going with a dark theme. You know, it is close to Halloween and here we are looking forward, what ghouls and goblins might be coming. And there's that pesky thing called an election that's right around the next month or two or three. But I think that I don't want to be dark. I want to be positive, because assembled here today, all of this community and the experts we have to speak are people we've been through up and down times in this field. And there is one thing that I would say, even though we have been through some really dark times, and we're going to talk about some of those developments in the treatment of children in immigration law, I would say overall, there is a growing awareness, particularly in Congress, that this vulnerable population needs to be protected. And there has been exponential growth in the work of nonprofit organizations and pro bono lawyers coming forward. And so, as dark as we may get today, please do not be frightened, but instead be empowered that yes, we have challenges ahead of us, but I think this group is incredibly well prepared. So let me quickly tell you how we're going to run the program. We have three questions we've prepared. We've discussed them. We're ready to talk about them with you from our three panelists. And then we've saved at least, we hope, 17 or 20 minutes for you to ask us the questions you have on your mind. Don't worry if you don't have any particular questions you want to pitch at us. We've got a whole long list we'd like to explore. My three experts are, first, just going to mention is Nicole Johnson. Nicole is a senior staff attorney with Safe Passage. That means she manages teams of junior attorneys, paralegals, as well as mentoring and supporting the entire organization and pro bono lawyers. And Nicole comes to Safe Passage with a really deep level of experience, particularly in family law, as well as immigration law and international human rights. After Nicole, we're going to hear today from the excellent Rex Chen, a former member of Safe Passage. We were so lucky to have him for several years working with us and training us and sharing his expertise. I've been in the field over 30 years, Rex just a little bit less than me. I've admired him and learned from him all those years. He is now leading the Legal Services Corporation in New York's immigration team, which is quite large, quite diverse, quite resourceful. And Rex brings to us just an incredible depth of knowledge, particularly in the intersection, I would say, of individual liberties and immigration law. And we have Eve Stotlin. And Rich gave me credit for founding Safe Passage, but it might in part have to do with a young woman who said, "May I audit your immigration class?" Eve had graduated from Yale Law School, found herself working at The Door, was representing immigrant youth. And The Door was one of the really first organizations to do this work of representing immigrant youth in immigration court. She started asking me questions I didn't know the answer to. Between learning from Eve and going to observe immigration court, where I saw what was happening on the children's docket, Eve was one of the very first attorneys who helped me train others. And so Eve, in case I've never officially said it, thank you so much for all that you have taught me and taught so many of us. Today, Eve is working in the philanthropic setting and is a mentor and guide and grantor herself now, working in the field of immigration law. So let us jump right into our questions, unless there's any preliminary question anyone has. I think I've done all the housekeeping things. All right, so our first question is, we're gonna start with Nicole and I. And Nicole, just by way of background, I think this group is very sophisticated, but what is the current state of play with how children are treated under US immigration law? When we were talking in preparation, we noted that there's been really aggressive behavior at the Southwest border, where in the past, many of the children in immigration court in New York did arrive from. So we've seen a decrease in the number of children actually managing to cross the border. Nevertheless, immigration court and children in New York City, there's still a large number of those children that need help. So I guess the question I have for you is, what is Safe Passage seeing? What are you seeing in the treatment of children in their administrative process as they seek relief?
Yeah, so I think just to start, I think it'd be interesting just talking about the TVPRA and like it actually, you know, was created to protect this vulnerable population of children, particularly children, you know, seeking asylum or children entering the country fleeing tremendous amounts of violence in their home countries. But we haven't even seen it be codified. And so we don't even know what it looks like for to have USCIS actually have to follow it. And particularly under, I think, under this administration, there really has been a concerted effort to kind of limit the protections provided under the TVPRA to this vulnerable population. And so they haven't actually changed any of the laws, but they have changed their interpretation of what of those laws and how they are, you know, being applied. And so
some I'm just gonna pause you for a second because sometimes we use acronyms and everyone knows. So the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act, it's a complex piece of legislation. Last time really adopted as a whole in 2008, pieces of it renewed, protecting women who are victims of trafficking. But this provision we're saying protecting children, as you say, hasn't been codified, meaning we don't really still have final regulations since 08.
Right.
Okay. So you were gonna go on though, I think, in talking about some of the changes you've seen in legal process that are impacting the children despite no statutory change.
Right. So one of the biggest ones I think is in regards to the classification of unaccompanied minors, which is a designation that provides special protections to young people who enter the country on their own. So for example, a young person who has been designated as an unaccompanied minor or a UAC and is seeking asylum is not subject to, let's say, having a credible fear interview at the border and is allowed to actually, although they are in immigration court proceedings, they're allowed to present their asylum claim, you know, in an asylum office before an officer in a non-adversarial setting, as opposed to having to go straight to immigration court, have a government attorney, you know, direct or have question them harshly, depending on the attorney, they're not subject to the 1 year filing deadlines for their asylum application. And so what this administration has sought to do is basically say, well, sorry, let me step back. Before this administration, once a young person was designated as an unaccompanied minor, they carried that title along with them throughout the rest of their proceedings. And so they were never subject to any kind of limitations in that respect. But this administration has sought to basically provide a ceiling to when someone would be considered an unaccompanied minor. And so in that way, prevent a lot of young people. And we've had, you know, there's been a lot of our clients that were potentially affected by this from actually being protected under those provisions, meaning that they would not be able to go to the immigration office or the asylum office to present their case first, and that they would have to do it defensively in an immigration court, or forced to file their applications as quickly as possible prior to the 1 year of their of them entering the United States.
So just recapping what you just said, we had a statute that was designed to adapt a procedure to the nature of a child traveling alone. And of course, everyone here knows they're not appointed counsel. So it's up to us in nonprofit world or pro bono world to represent these young people if we are connected with them. What the administration's done, as Nicole just said, is dismantle one of the key protections for children in that one category. And of course, it's added a lot of other hurdles. So if it's all right, I'm going to move to some of those other hurdles. I've asked both Eve and Rex now, and I'm going to start with Eve, to talk about some of the other changes this administration has made that you think have the greatest impact on the provision of services to youth. So Eve, you wanted to start?
Sure. First of all, I want to say how wonderful it is to be on this conversation with so many old friends and colleagues. It really is special. Thank you for inviting me back into your world. So I'm going to talk quickly about two developments that are linked. Fee increases, how much people have to pay if they want to apply to the government to regularize their status, and two, the economic crisis. So both of these have to do with money. One is specifically an immigration policy, fee increases. The other one, economic crisis, not an immigration policy at all, right? But immigrants in the United States live in a cultural and economic context. And so these things are both very linked. So in the middle of an economic crisis, in fact, this was supposed to take place on October 2nd, the government decided this was a good time to double all of the fees. As just a couple of examples, I would say maybe the heart of immigration applications, the adjustment of status application. We might call this a green card application. Not to get the card, but the thing that gives you the status that entitles you to the card. Adjustment of status, the price was to go from $1,225, already not a small chunk of change, but to $2,270. So really significant increase. Naturalization, a little less relevant to specifically children, but still important. And we know children live in households with other people who may need naturalization, is to go from $640 to $1,170. So almost exactly twice the amount. In addition, the new regulations that were to go into effect in October eliminate most fee waivers. So you could think about hardship or proving that, you know, you just can't afford this. There's still some grounds, and one of those still is that people are special immigrant juveniles, a certain kind of a vulnerable child, but it eliminates most others. And then really importantly, for the first time ever in the history of U.S. asylum law, the regulations impose a $50 fee on asylum applications. Now, this is a tiny fee, right? I'm saying that adjustment of status is $2,000, and this is just $50. But it's just as important in a way, because it sets the ground for something that almost by definition should be free to have a fee. So this means that people who come fleeing persecution and want to ask the government for protection have to pay in order to ask for that protection. And it leaves the U.S., if this goes into effect, as one of the one of just four countries, I believe, that has an asylum program where asylum requires a fee. So it's a pretty historic and terrible change. Happily, nine different nonprofits, advocacy groups, have sued to stop this from being implemented. And right now it is temporarily halted by the courts, but we really don't know how that will play out. So I think my time is up, so I'll just say very quickly that everything you read about the economic crisis is real, and everything that you read about the economic crisis applies to the children that Safe Passage represents. They live in households where they depend on either their own earnings or the earnings of the adults in those households. And as those earnings have been decimated, they have suffered as well. So I'll turn it over to, I believe, Rex.
Go ahead, Rex. You were going to talk about other things the government's doing to make life more complex.
It's great to see everybody. My name is Rex Chen. And let me talk to you about another big problem, and those are immigration backlogs, immigration court backlogs. But let me explain to you in the context of how it really affects young immigrants. Now, many young immigrants that come to the U.S. are already very traumatized. There may have been killings or sexual violence in the neighborhoods that they fled from. They may be escaping death threats. And so revisiting these traumatic memories actually causes more trauma for our young clients. And we really don't want to raise it at more than we have to. Also, chaos and uncertainty about how their cases are going actually really weighs on them. These are very, for some very traumatized clients. These kind of delays and chaos actually makes it harder to win our cases. It doesn't just take up more time and energy. So let me give you some examples. Sometimes immigration courts don't hold the hearings when they're scheduled. For example, before COVID even happened, sometimes they'd say, this judge won't be in for that week, but let's not call the people coming in for the court case. Let's just slap a piece of paper on the bulletin board, have everyone prepare and come on in, and then they'll see it on the bulletin board and then leave. Seems totally unprofessional and unacceptable. And then sometimes they'll double book a hearing and say, we want to maximize our time. So let's have two people come in for their cases. And if we don't get to yours and you happen to be the one heard second, too bad. Thanks for preparing. Come and prepare again a whole nother time. I don't know if you've heard, maybe you can nod your head if you've heard about fake court dates. Have you heard about fake court dates? Okay, some of you have. So what are they? The immigration authorities are supposed to, when they give you the notice that you have to go to court, they're supposed to tell you the date of the first court date. Now the court, they usually don't do that, and courts have not yet ruled on how much they'll be penalized for not following the rules. But just to play it safe, they feel like maybe some of them, let's put a court date. So why don't we just put a fake court date? Okay, a date that doesn't exist, that the court doesn't even know about, but we'll put it down and say, ha ha, we put a date on your initial papers. And then hundreds of people will come in, and then the grouchy guards say, why'd you even come in? You don't have a court date today. I don't know what you're talking about. Everyone get out of here. And you've just done all the prep and gone to court for a fake court date, completely unprofessional and frustrating and stressful. Now, during COVID, they've been giving blanket announcements for non-detained cases in New York City, but they give it sort of at the last second. It's usually either 0 days or at most 3 days before your big evidence packet is due. And of course, you got to work for weeks before it's due to actually get it ready. Again, re-traumatizing your client to get all the evidence and revisiting all the memories when, it's just going to be postponed because of COVID, it turns out. And then these backlogs mean a long time until your final hearing in many cases. And the immigration judges just don't have enough staffing, and the Immigration Judges Union has complained about it. Finally, I'll mention that there is a movement among the ICE lawyers, the government lawyers right now, to try to put cases back on that were administratively closed and say, let's put them back on the docket, which really doesn't make sense. I'll pause here and see. I think Lenny, if
I know Rex, I'm going to come back to you to talk specifically about the asylum regs. But in the meantime, that last note you talked about, where the government attorneys, we call them ICE or Office of Chief Counsel, OCC. Nicole's going to talk about the extra effort it's taking with those personnel. That's very different than what we experienced in the last few years. Go ahead, Nicole.
The large majority of our young people that we represent are eligible for special removal steps. And it's because it's like a multi-step process, the children who are in removal proceedings have to get those proceedings terminated in order to, once their I-360 or their special immigrant juvenile status petition has been approved, you know, and USCIS says that this child, you know, should not be returned, that they are classified as a special immigrant. Then we have to move to get the removal proceedings terminated before we can then apply for their green card. But what happened, especially under this administration, is that the court has actually decided that they're not really going to take any action unless the government attorney or the Office of Chief Counsel agrees to it. And so, immigration practitioners, or what we have to do is we have to reach out to government counsel and ask them, hey, would you agree to join our motion to terminate proceedings so that this child can apply for their green card before, you know, USCIS? Or if you're not going to agree to join my motion, would you at least agree to not oppose it, so that at least then the judge can, you know, grant our motion, and then they can apply for their green card. But under this administration, initially, there was a blanket policy on the part of the government attorneys that said, we are not going to agree to any joint motions, and we're not going to say that we're not going to oppose anything. And so it created a particular hurdle for our young people, in that they would then have to file their green card application, not on paper and not, you know, without the threat of removal, but instead in a trial before an immigration judge with a government attorney, again, questioning them. And then the other issue with that is that not only is it more of an adversarial setting, but then because of the extreme backlog in immigration court, these trials were being set out 2 and 3 years. So further delaying this child's ability to receive their green card. And then even worse now with COVID, let's say any of those trials that had been scheduled for this year have kind of been indefinitely canceled. And so who knows when they're going to be able to apply for their green card. And so you have the situation where, you know, the child is stuck in kind of this limbo where they're still in removal proceedings, although they have relief available to them, but they're not able to move forward because of what's going on with the government council.
I think I'm just going to sneak in here with a metaphor about what you're saying. First of all, this is my opinion. I believe ICE consciously took this position to create a backlog in immigration court so that politically they could start showing Congress these enormous numbers in the immigration court. They reopened case files they had closed for 4, 5, 6, 10, 12 years. They are obstructing what's called administrative closure. They've tried to get rid of that entire process of taking cases that are not active and putting them on a shelf. And now they're physically obstructing efficiency in the immigration court. And there's no tool the immigration judge has to force the government counsel to be reasonable. If we were in federal court, a judge would hold a telephone conference, knock some heads together, say, counsel, let's stipulate, let's narrow these issues, let's move on, my time is valuable. This is not the culture inside immigration court. But the metaphor that was forming in my mind, I'm picturing the subway station in Union Square. I'm sure we've all been in there. And the poor kid wants to go from the green line, you know, to the blue line, or to maybe go over to Brooklyn. And they have to have all their paperwork, and they have to get the right swipe to go from place to place. Meanwhile, there's this ogre called the Immigration Customs Enforcement Attorney, basically saying, no, not yet. Wait, not yet. And you're just stuck. You're stuck. Imagine to a teenager, a lawyer explaining the delay. Time when you're that age, of course, seems like you say, wait a year, that's like waiting 10. So I really feel for the Safe Passage attorneys and the pro bono lawyers trying to communicate patients comfort, security. All right, so let me come back to Rex, because probably this summer we were all, Safe Passage did an excellent job of writing comments, as did many of the other people I think on this call today. I personally wrote comments, I think more than 600 were submitted to a massive asylum law change. And Rex, I think you were gonna talk about what they're trying to do through regulation to the field of asylum.
Yes, now I could talk for the next 30 minutes on this, but I won't. I'm gonna talk until Caroline hopefully cuts me off. So I looked through the 160 pages of their plan of what they're gonna implement to make it harder to win asylum. And I thought I'd just go through as many of 8 points until Caroline hopefully cuts me off. Caroline, you gotta cut me off here.
All right, starting a timer.
All right, how much time I have left? 2 minutes, 1 minute? Two, all right, here we go, 2 minutes, right? Hey, can you believe it? Felonies, they've added felonies. These are in various stages of being implemented. They haven't all been implemented yet. Felonies, a felony conviction of any kind that any wacky state decides to define as a felony blocks you from asylum. Doesn't matter if it's just shoplifting, doesn't matter if you got no jail time, you're out of there for asylum. Also, if you pass through a country, let's say Mexico, and you don't actually decide as an unaccompanied child, you don't decide to stop there and decide to file your asylum claim through the Mexican asylum system, forget it. Even if you're an unaccompanied child, you can't get it. And they don't even care whether the country like Mexico has a functioning asylum system. You had to go and apply or forget it, no asylum for you. They're actually trying to get rid of protections for those who are fleeing because they're being persecuted based on domestic violence or based on gang violence or just generalized violence in the country. They're specifically trying to cut that out, the ways that we could already win under existing law and international law. They're trying to get rid of considering, let's say you're briefly detained many times by the government because of your politics. They say, hey, ignore all brief detentions. You can't use any of that to help your case for some reason. It's very artificial. Let's say there's an extremely onerous rule that's chilling people and it's on the books. Hey, if you can't show they're actually enforcing that, then you can't even cite it. You're just gonna ignore that as if it doesn't even exist, even if everyone's afraid of it. Also, any harm that they say is arising out of military strife, forget that, you can't cite any of that. So that could actually hurt, for example, to make this concrete, protester in Hong Kong, you might be jailed under China's new national security law. They'll say, they could say, hey, that's military strife, pretend that didn't even happen. Caroline, you got 10 seconds to interrupt me here. You know, it could be based on political opinions against a quasi-governmental group, like the gangs essentially run the city. Can't cite that. They're not officially the government. All these kinds and more. Oh, and there's much more. But I'm going to stop there because Caroline—
2 minutes.
Okay, great. Caroline, you cut me off. Over to you, Lenny.
I'm muting myself. Thank you. Wow, Rex, very impressive. I get to sneak in here though and say what my comment focused on. These regulations were not just the regulations of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. They were the regulations, actually their name wasn't on it. It's US Citizenship and Immigration Service, the Asylum Directorate. So they're the ones who drafted these in partnership with the immigration court. So tell me a judicial system where the judges sit down with the prosecutors to write the substantive rules. So that struck me as so inherently in violation of our basic concepts of separation of powers. And while this is an area of administrative law, even in administrative law, the Supreme Court has said there should be a separation from those who adjudicate and those who advocate. And here are these two different divisions put their heads together about ways to obfuscate, break, bar adjudication of asylum claims. And so, as I said, hundreds of comments were put in. I was really impressed with the work of the legal team at Safe Passage Project in putting together an excellent comment. And if you would like to read it, you can find it on the Safe Passage Project website. All right, we're gonna move now to the future. And that's basically what we were sort of starting with when we convened this roundtable. We said, how can we mobilize now? What action can we all take to bring about a better change for immigrant youth? Should we ask Congress to be more explicit in statutory protections? Can we do more community awareness building, more community support from state and local government? is there a role for individual or institutional philanthropy to help focus our national challenge on meeting the needs of international children? I want to say that each of us is very well informed in this area. And as we answer this question, officially we're speaking in our individual capacity rather than the spirit of any one particular organization. All right, so let us start, I think for this first one, I don't remember who I had first, but let me go to Rex first, if that's all right, Rex, and then we'll let you have a bit of a breather, and then we'll come to you, Eve.
Sure. I don't think I was supposed to be first, but I am ready.
Okay.
You know, something I want to point out is that in the New York City area, there's been amazingly great cooperation among the different nonprofit organizations. We haven't really seen as much of the competing against each other. The iCare Coalition, thanks so much, Eve, for working so hard on it, has worked together. Safe Passage is a big part of it in helping unaccompanied children and collaborating, sharing information, tips, and techniques, and working with the court system. After the Muslim ban at JFK Airport, so many lawyers volunteered, a great collaboration, really spearheaded by Immigrant Arc from all the different nonprofit lawyers on a broad range of issues, even after decamping from JFK Airport. And then our nonprofits are sharing information about the issues, emerging issues that we see, such as the RFM litigation to try to help fight an illegal policy by the government about abused and abandoned children. And the actual litigation was led by Legal Aid Society, but everyone was raising the issue. And then we at Legal Services NYC sued the New York City immigration courts about how they're conducting during COVID, but with the help of many of the nonprofits flagging the issues. And we even have ongoing collaborations. We're talking with the social workers at many of our organizations about the illegal education law obstacles that our young immigrants face across New York City.
Thank you, Rex. Go ahead, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, go ahead.
But there's more. You know, there's with the emphasis on Black Lives Matter, it's really important to address community concerns and prioritize what those directly affected are concerned about. It's really an effort to involve communities more in the strategy and also taking time to learn what their concerns are. That's where we see where the deep seated problems are, the cause of the issues. Social workers are really playing a great role in responding to their needs, such as food and housing crises we've seen across the board during COVID. And we can see the power of people in organizing. With the forcibly separated children, the huge protests, the op-ed pieces, the outrage really made the government back down. And same for the mass protests about the Muslim ban all across at the JFK airport that day. Thank you, Lenny.
Yeah, the travel ban, of course, is still in force. It's still problematic, still pieces of litigation going on against it. I do want to say I recently read a report, and it Safe Passage does tend to focus representation on children coming from Central America, but of course we have children from many different countries. People who are Caribbean Black or Central American Black or Black from Africa are disproportionately arrested, rearrested, picked up by ICE again. And so it is, there is inherent racial discrimination in immigration enforcement as well. And I know we're all very aware of it. I'm gonna turn to Eve now to talk. I think Eve, you were gonna give us a pitch about what about city and state government and the role of larger philanthropy.
Sure. So I think it's really important, and I think everyone on this call knows this, but to go back a bit and say that the group of providers that represent most of the children in immigration court in New York City are funded and were funded especially initially by a public-private partnership. It's not just New York Community Trust, many of you on this call, but also the city that has been funding these efforts. And it's part of a bigger trend in city funding. In 2013, so just 7 years ago, the city spent about $7 million on free legal services for immigrants. In 2019, the city spent $48 million. So it increased sevenfold from $7 million to $48 million. And this is really because of all of our efforts and the efforts of all of the community organizers that we work with to educate the city about what's at stake here and the tremendous benefit that you provide for people, and I'm going to say especially for young people, right, because you're providing a lifetime benefit when you can prevent them from being deported, one, and to get them legal status, right? That's something that they're going to enjoy for their entire life. And so even the state has stepped up in recent years. They were a little later to this party, but they now contribute about $10 million to immigration representation statewide. We all know that the city and the state have fallen on very, very hard financial times. They're facing budget crises. And so we want to look carefully at what happens to this funding and think about how those of us who are funders, not from the city side, right, from private, from corporate, from philanthropy, how we can help manage any cuts that might come down the road.
And we were hoping to make progress on the state side, and Nicole's going to report about some of the efforts that Safe Passage has been a leader on in the state legislature. So Nicole, I'm going to pitch it to you.
Yes. So, you know, I think that it's a very interesting and I would say exciting, but, you know, exciting time to be an immigration lawyer, particularly, you know, immigration lawyers who focus on young people. And so, you know, under our mission statement that, you know, no young person should be representing themselves in immigration court or have to, you know, face this process on their own. We really have been pushing for an access to counsel, kind of to expand universal representation for young people, to include young people in New York State. And so we had initially started the campaign to kind of start pushing for this expansion of universal representation, kind of looking at some of our partners in the legal field here in New York. You know, for example, NYFUP, which is the New York, I always mess up this acronym.
New York Immigration Family Unity Project.
Here we go, which provides universal representation for detained immigrants already. And so kind of building off of that model, I'm really trying to push for young people to be included. And so last June, 2019, there actually was a bill introduced by Assemblyman Havasi, which actually sought to include a lot of the provisions that we were looking to see for our access to counsel for young people. And so Safe Passage has kind of led the charge in helping to shape that bill and really kind of push it forward.
So I just want to say sometimes maybe some of you have seen this up at Syracuse. They have a project called TRAC, and I suggested to them they start doing a report by zip code. And so they were able to show what they called representation deserts. And although it wasn't broken down by youth and adults, one of the deserts is Long Island. And of course, Safe Passage is one of the only nonprofits that is serving that area. There's very, very few. It's a dense population of Central American youth, in part because their families have settled there. And, you know, it's America in miniature in a way, you know, the great economic divides of the very, very wealthy and the very hardworking poor, and local government that is not always responsive and receptive. I know the Safe Passage team based in Long Island is doing quite a lot of work with the school system there, trying to educate the police, build community, build safety, and it takes a lot of extra work. So we'll all have to watch what will happen as, you know, local and state budgets shrink. Immigrant youth will probably, unfortunately, be on the short side of that. And so that maybe means even a greater demand for the pro bono kind of network that Safe Passage has been able to build. And our great partnerships with groups like Legal Services, The Door, Catholic Charities, Legal Aid, and others. All right, we're really good on time. I'm impressed. We even gained back a minute to allow you to ask questions. So we're a small enough group that you could, you know, just wave at me, or you could unmute yourself, you could use the chat box. Is there anyone there who, is there something you would like us to address that we haven't touched on and go deeper? Anyone out there that has a question? Hi, Heidi, you're waving at me, go ahead.
Yeah, hi everyone. Thank you for the presentation, it was really great. I'm curious, I'd love to hear how the the Title 42 expulsions at the border are impacting the number of clients or the way clients are being served by Safe Passage.
So I'm going to explain what Title 42 means. It's a reference to the law that is the authority for Health and Human Services to declare a pandemic and to close the borders. And Mr. Trump's administration has taken that and run with it. And so the data is that they have used it aggressively on the Southwest border in particular. And it doesn't necessarily supersede the Trafficking Victim Protection Reauthorization Act of the special protections that should be for victims of trafficking or for unaccompanied youth. But what the government has been doing is evading even reporting these children in the normal immigration system, using Title 42 to apprehend them, hold them in unlicensed, unofficial facilities. You may have seen the stories of holding children in hotel rooms. And so there have been record numbers of expulsion under this statute. Nicole, maybe I should ask you though, I don't know if it's affecting the Safe Passage Project category of cases because most of our young people are already here, but maybe you have a comment on it.
Yeah, I'm not sure that we have seen the effects of it thus far, in that there are so many kids in New York already, or New York City particularly, that are unrepresented still. And so really, you know, we haven't had a lag in the amount of kids that we are seeking to assist here in New York.
Yeah, I'm just going to jump in with another comment, though. I think some of us may have seen the video where a young lawyer is trying to reach the children on the fourth floor of a hotel, and he's shouting to the children, and he's being blocked by not government people. The government, HHS, has used its government contracting authority to hire subcontractors, and they're, you know, they're not licensed, qualified people to take care of children. Once you have those kind of backdoor black ops mechanisms in place, it's very hard to dismantle that unless we have an aggressive congressional oversight. So yesterday, the House Judiciary Committee issued a pretty scathing report about the separation of children policy. I do think Congressman Nadler and other members of the House Judiciary Committee are really focusing on this. And I, just before the program started, I pulled up all the bills that are pending. There's bills that go in both directions and all kinds of political alignments, but it does look like Congress is going to hopefully be more thorough in its oversight. And that's something that would say, if I have a theme, that is that regardless of who succeeds in this election, we all need to be more conversant, informing and educating the staff in Congress and the Congress members themselves to be more vigilant. All right, how about another question? Does anyone else have one? Nobody has one. Yes, I see one. Anthony, go ahead, or Tony.
To this issue that we might be losing city and state funding, since philanthropy usually doesn't respond well to the notion of filling a gap created by, you know, government funding cuts, have you done any thinking of how to package that need in a slightly different way to go after philanthropic dollars so it's not just seen as filling the gap that government should be doing?
So Eve, maybe you want to address that a little bit if you thought about it, and then maybe Rich, you want to join in.
You are absolutely right. The trust, my employer does in fact have such a policy. We break it sometimes, and I think in the future, in fact, we may have to break it a little bit more, right? I mean, what grantee of New York Community Trust in the coming years will not have been hit by city and state budget cuts, right? So clearly it cannot be applied during a budget crisis sort of to the letter of the law, right? I think that we will have to be somewhat flexible about that. However, it's also always important, and I think I'm speaking to the choir here a bit, to understand that as vast as the trust's resources or any other philanthropic agency's resources may seem, they pale in comparison to city and state budget resources. So, you know, I said 48 million. My entire allocation of the money I give away is a fraction of 48 million. So there becomes a really difficult situation. Even when we can respond, we could never actually make the nonprofits equal, right? Even we could never replace all of the cuts in a time like this. I do believe that so far, and please correct me if I'm wrong, the advocates did an amazing job this year, and the 2021 city budget is intact. And on that positive note, I'll turn it over to Rich.
Great, thanks. Fun question. No, everything that's been said is exactly right. There's the response in terms of all the work that literally every person on this call is doing. We're, you know, from all of our different perspectives, we're working with people who have a lack of resources, young people in particular. Safe Passage, our particular situation is, with some intent, we have never gotten past 35% or so government funding. So the immediate challenge of being tied to a particular contract or a particular relationship within a city government agency is something we have a bit more resilience around than some others. And we also, in part with this coalition that we've been working with for so many years that Eve and Lenny helped create, we have built enough relationships across the government that this year in July, when the city council, for example, announced 20 to 30% cuts at the beginning of the year for everybody, they actually held our contract steady. Now those contracts, it's very important to understand, are literally not worth the paper they are printed on. At any moment, our counterpart at a government agency can send us an email that says, hey, by the way, we're only giving you 10 cents on the dollar. So that, you know, we can't count on it, but it is a concerning situation, and it's one that we just have to build resilience by continuing to have conversations, particularly with the folks that we have come to know over the longer periods of time.
So Rich, I'm going to segue here now to Odile's question, which I think is like such a beautiful question. If Mr. Biden is elected, will he immediately cancel all these crazy executive orders that Mr. Trump has issued? Can we rescind the proposed rules? What will happen? So first, I'm just going to do a little bit of the law professor thing and answer that a little bit. This is often a challenge as we have if we have change in government. So it's sometimes called the midnight rule phenomena. It's a very slow, long, onerous process for agencies to draft formal rules and then to have those rules become final rules. What the Trump administration did was do a number of rules where they made them on a short track and then they made them an interim rule. That means if they did go through that process where rules are either adopted or have the status of interim rule, then the new administration has to formally go through that process too. They can't, they can do a fast track, they can go interim role, they can do some policy guidance about stretching the corners, but there are quite a number of the really horrific things that I think the Biden administration could step into and almost turn into a positive. Let me give you just one example. This may be a little Pollyanna. I actually got to speak at the White House in 2014, 2014, I think. And Vice President Biden had convened us. And he was talking about his visits to Central America and meeting with the heads of state there. And he said, we've asked Congress for $800 million for stabilizing government in the region to create greater security. And it's just stuck in Congress. And of course, at that point, they weren't dealing with a political coalition that was willing to address it. So Mr. Trump has claimed that he's negotiated these safe third country agreements, which are going to block asylum eligibility or really making young people insecure along the path. I could envision a Biden administration stepping in with a Congress that was willing to fund it to try to create some long-term safety and solutions. It may be that, yes, some young people might have to seek asylum in a neighboring nation, but if we used our economic resources to help those countries build that capacity to build facility, I've actually heard some Mexican academics say this could be one of the best things that ever happened to Mexico, because there are pockets of Mexico that are have lost their young people generation, that they need the help. On the other hand, climate change is already affecting this region. There's droughts, there's fungus, there's greater poverty, which increases the terror within the criminal organizations. So this will be a long, difficult challenge to fix systemically. Mr. Biden has already said in writing, there's been some policy points, but he's already said as well that he would make sure that there would be no more separation of families at the border, that's for sure. So there are lots of things the administration can do, and many academics and others are working on white papers and quick lists and things you can do rapidly, but there are other things that will take some time, which brings me again to thinking we need to ask Congress to do some of it. Rex, Nicole, or Eve, did either any of you want to add anything to that question Odile asked us, like what can be repealed or what have you heard the Biden administration might be focusing on?
I'd love to bring up an issue that's of particular concern to me because I think it's difficult. Not just in that it takes a lengthy administrative process, but that it's actually hard to resolve, right? It's hard to know what the right response is, which is virtual refugee, well, they're not virtual, and the non-refugee camps that have formed, the unofficial, thank you, refugee camps that have formed on the southern side of the U.S.-Mexico border, which I haven't seen the latest statistics, but there's an estimate, for example, that 60,000 people might be living in these areas. And that doesn't include those who are in the same border towns, but might be staying in hotels or might have some meager resources to allow themselves to live just outside of the unofficial refugee camps. And I would say that we all should look in the event that Biden is our next president, we should look very carefully at what he does. It is difficult, even if it's the right thing to do, to immediately allow 60,000 people in. It's difficult. It's not that many people for a country of our size, but it's unclear how that should be managed. And I think it is potentially politically explosive and something that somebody could want to avoid. Because it seen as so hard, right? But those people have been waiting for their turn for months and years under tremendous hardship, and they must be allowed to seek asylum in the United States.
The Supreme Court has accepted jurisdiction over the litigation on this case. It's just Orwellian. The name of it is the Migration Protection Protocols. Supreme Court did accept jurisdiction in the case. So I have to say, no matter who's president, I imagine they'll use the cover of how the court rules on this issue. And again, I'm gonna go back to Congress. The Trump administration may have activated this horrific wait in Mexico, but if you actually read the statute, they're reading it in an incorrect manner, if you ask me, but it is true that in 1996, Congress did say that in an urgent situation, the government might be able to extend that program. All right, so we only have a few more minutes. I think we have 4 more minutes to continue discussion. Nicole or Rex, did you want to address any other thing that you think the new administration might do? Rex, go ahead.
Very briefly, you know, where there's litigation going on, maybe they can convince the DOJ to drop certain opposition and drop certain appeals. That could be useful. I know that in the news is to do a task force to find over 500 forcibly separated parents. So there's definitely a focus, I feel, on family separation issues. Generally in the platform, better policies on asylum, the public charge issue, DACA and TPS is in that platform, and also ending workplace raids. That's what people have seen in the platform. Who knows how high it is on the priorities though.
And Nicole, did you have anything you wanted to add? Nope, you're okay. All right, so some other people have to go to other calls. We're gonna do a nice stop right at 1 o'clock. So it's 3 to 4 minutes to go. Did anyone have another question at all? Rich, is there anything you want to say in the end, verbally, not just by text?
No, I mean, I'm thrilled to have everyone here. If anyone has a question, raise your hand. I think the I'm just so grateful and appreciative for the knowledge that everyone has brought and for the perspectives that you all bring to this conversation. So thank you, Lenny. Thank you, Rex. Thank you, Nicole. And thank you, Eve. Not to, you should say thank you too, Lenny, but I have to say it because I really feel it.
Oh, well, I do want to say thank you. First of all, I'm really glad to be part of helping Safe Passage and continuing to be a, what did you call me? A godmother. I think I like that. Given that my children are unlikely to get married soon, I'm ready. I see that my mother-in-law is on the call, Sheila Wellington. And Sheila, can we get those kids hurrying up? Because we need to have some more young people in our family. So meanwhile, you all are our family, and I'm very grateful to have worked with this team of outstanding speakers. The truth is, each one of these people could have spoken to us for an hour in depth about the work they do, and we would have learned so much. So thank you all for asking great questions and for being prepared and sharing, and I will say goodbye.